White Bread Foundation. We're taping our king beaten off his crown. My country, tears of the sweet land of irony, spoonful of sugar to wash it down.
Welcome to Culture Wars Radio. This is one of our supplemental podcasts, a shorter podcast that we're going to do a couple times a month. That might focus on a specific issue. And in particular, we're now going to start using these to explain constitutional concepts in a way that people can understand, to help them understand when they're reading about a Supreme Court ruling and such. And so we're going to start doing that from now on, not exclusively, but more often, to help our listeners understand some of these very complex legal issues and rulings that come down from the courts. And our first one is going to focus on standards of review. And Dan, being the con law expert here, I just play one on the internet.
Quite well, I might add.
I'm going to let him sort of lead this discussion, and I'm just going to jump in with questions and maybe some clarification. So let's start with explain what a standard of review is.
Sure. And at the same time that I do that, I want to spend a minute or so talking about why it's important, why we care about these things called standards of review. If you're a friend of Ed or a follower of Ed, then you've heard this term used with some regularity before. Why do we care about these things called standards of review? The answer is because this is sort of the judicial toolkit, if you will. When it comes time for a court or a judge to answer the question, is that legal? Is that constitutional? Can the president actually do that? Can Congress make that kind of a law? This, the standard of review, is the set of tools that courts and judges use to answer those kinds of questions. So that's what it is that makes this so important. In terms of what the standard of review is, the name kind of suggests the answer. This is the threshold that a law or an action or a policy must satisfy analytically in order to meet constitutional muster. And so, stated a bit differently, if the question is, can the president do that, then the applicable standard of review tells us what level the president's conduct has to satisfy in order to be constitutional. Does that make sense, Ed?
Yeah. Although, so there are two separate questions here. One is the question of, you know, if you're taking that specific issue of what can the president do that? Okay. So the first level is, what does the Constitution say? What powers are delegated to the president in the Constitution?
Right. Yes.
The standard of review is sort of superimposed on top of that, right?
Correct. That's right. We're not talking about the substantive law so much here. What does the Constitution say? Or what do past cases say? That's not what we're concerned with. We are instead concerned with what tools courts are going to use in order to answer that question. And it may make the most sense, Ed, for us simply to start talking about standards of review. And I think that once we start to do that, then our listeners will kind of figure out what the distinction is between substantive law and standards of review.
Yes. So there's three levels of review, essentially.
Functionally, basically, yes, that's right. Although there are actually four, and we're going to get into that a little bit today.
Okay. And what are they?
Okay. So what I tell students is sort of the basic unit of currency when it comes to standards of review is something called rational basis review. At a bare minimum, any law created by any government at any level must satisfy what we call rationality or rational basis review in order to be constitutional. Now, as we will see, there are a small handful of laws that must go above and beyond mere rationality in order to pass judicial muster, if you will. And the most common elevated standards of review are something called intermediate scrutiny and strict scrutiny. And we're going to talk about each of these three, in fact, four levels of review in a bit more detail. But let's start with rational basis review. At a bare minimum, any law must be rational to survive. When it comes to a law that has to satisfy rationality review, as with any standard of review, a standard of review, we should probably note, is composed of two basic elements. There's a means test and there's an ends test. Let's talk about each of those, and we'll do so in the specific context of rational basis review. On rational basis review, the law or policy or practice or whatever it is that we're reviewing simply has to be justified by reference to something called a legitimate government interest. Legitimate government interest. What, you ask, is a legitimate government interest? It would be easier for me to tell you what is not legitimate than for me to tell you what is legitimate. A government law or policy or practice that is motivated by, for example, saving the government money, that's a legitimate government interest. Ease of administration and enforcement, that's a legitimate government interest. So on the ends testing, then, for rational basis review, the law simply has to be justified by reference to a legitimate government interest. When it comes to means testing, the means testing standard looks at the law or the policy itself and asks, in the case of rational basis review, you're going to be surprised to hear this, the question that we ask is, does the law rationally relate to achieving that particular legitimate government interest? Now, note, importantly, on rational basis review, it is the challenger's burden to prove either that the government doesn't have any legitimate interest to justify the law, or that the means the government has chosen, the law itself, does not rationally relate to achieving that interest. The challenger has to negate one or both of those. And that is no small task on rationality review, I'm here to tell you. I jokingly say to students, you will find it easier to scale Mount Everest in your stocking feet using a salad fork for an ice pick than to defeat a law on genuine rational basis review. In fact, courts are sort of willing to indulge an informal presumption, and it is informal. It's not a formal presumption. But the informal presumption goes something like this. On rational basis review, the government wins because in the overwhelming majority of cases that are reviewed on rationality review, that's precisely what the outcome is. The government wins. So, to briefly—
99% of the time.
99.999% of the time, yes.
Once they've decided the standard of review, they've essentially already decided the case.
And therein, I'm glad you raised that point, Ed, because therein lies a crucial point about why the standard of review is so important. The standard of review, as I think will become evident during the course of our talk here, can determine the outcome of the case by itself. On rationality review, presumption that you can indulge, informal though it may be, is the government wins. So, to recap then, on rationality review, we've got means testing, which is rational relationship. We have ends testing, legitimate government interest, and the burden is allocated to the challenger. Okay. Now, as we said, there are a small handful of laws where the rules are a little bit different. Rationality review alone won't cut it. And let me give you a couple of examples, and I think you'll see why simple rationality doesn't make it. Let's say we have a law that classifies people on the basis of gender, or that classifies people on the basis of religion, or race, or ethnicity. Once we start to draw classifications based upon those kinds of categories, you should be able to see why our antennae need to go up. We need to say to ourselves, well, now, wait a minute. If you're going to start making distinctions based upon the faith that people practice or the color of someone's skin, then you're going to have to do better than simple garden variety, plain vanilla rationality. And indeed, when we start drawing those kinds of classifications, that's where the burden increases. So we don't have a whole lot of time to discuss specifics, but let's move from the lowest end of the spectrum to the highest end of the spectrum. At the opposite end of the standard of review spectrum from rational basis review is something called strict scrutiny. Now, again, this term is probably familiar to you if you've followed Ed for any significant period of time. Strict scrutiny gets applied in a limited number of circumstances, like, for example, laws that classify on the basis of race, nationality, ethnicity. These laws get strict scrutiny review. In addition, there are a handful of what the Supreme Court has characterized as fundamental rights that, if they are infringed significantly by the government, then the government is going to have to justify that infringement by strict scrutiny. Okay? We're talking here about a group of rights and interests that fall under the general umbrella of what we might call privacy. Reproductive rights, for example, the right to use contraceptives, the right to terminate a pregnancy. Family types of rights, the right to live together under the same roof with persons to whom you are related by blood, adoption, or marriage. Those are fundamental rights. Parental rights, the right to bring your children up in a manner that you see fit, to control the manner and method by which they are raised. That is an example of a fundamental right. So, certain fundamental rights and certain equal protection classifications, race, ethnicity, national origin, get strict scrutiny review. What do we mean? Well, again, here, there's a means test and there's an ends test. Let's start with the latter. In strict scrutiny review, the government must demonstrate that the law or practice or policy or whatever it is intended to serve, here's the magic word, a compelling governmental interest, a compelling interest. Now, unfortunately, the court has never given a clear sort of bright line definition for what makes an interest compelling or not. It's one of those sort of we can't define it, but we know it when we see it types of things. So, for example, protecting human life and health, clearly compelling governmental interests. Protecting children from harm, clearly compelling governmental interests. It is the government's burden here. Again, contrast rationality review where it's the challenger's burden. On strict scrutiny, it's the government's burden to prove that this law or practice or whatever is motivated by one or more compelling interests. That's the ends test. On the means testing side, the government has to show that it has selected, and here come the magic words again, the least restrictive means of achieving its governmental interest. It's a means testing. It's a tailoring requirement. How closely is this law tailored to achieving the compelling interest that the government says it's trying to achieve? If a court concludes that a law that is subject to strict scrutiny is over-inclusive, that is to say, the government has reached out and restricted more than it really needs to, that's going to be almost instantly fatal on strict scrutiny review. And guess what? Like there's a sort of informal presumption on rationality review, so too there's an informal presumption on strict scrutiny review. And that informal presumption is that the government loses on strict scrutiny review. The court has sometimes called it strict in theory and fatal in fact when it comes to testing a law or a practice or a procedure. So, I'm sorry, go ahead, Ed.
Well, let's do a real quick example of this. The Hobby Lobby case.
Sure.
Is a great example of this, where the Supreme Court said, yes, there is clearly a government interest, a compelling interest in making sure that women have access to birth control. The people have access to birth control.
Yes.
In the Hobby Lobby case. But they said the policy was not the least restrictive means of ensuring the achievement of that interest. And they mentioned several other ways that the government could achieve the same thing without any imposition on Hobby Lobby. Right. They could simply make birth control free and available to everyone.
Right.
For example. Well, and
again,
an example of where they agreed on the ends test.
Right.
Not on the means test.
And you again raise an important point, Ed. In practice, this is quite often how strict scrutiny review plays out. The government shows up in court and it says, our compelling interest is yada, yada, yada. The court will say something like, we are willing to assume, for the sake of argument, that yada, yada, yada is in fact a compelling interest. Now, let's take a look at the means the government has selected to achieve that interest. And of course, we know that if a judge sitting back in her chambers, feet up on the desk, taking pot shots at this law, can come up with any less restrictive means than what the government has selected, bang, that is instantly fatal to the law. And that is how it usually works out. Laws on strict scrutiny usually get killed on means testing, not on ends testing.
And that's because there are essentially an infinite number of hypothetical alternatives.
It's trivially
the fact that those things couldn't actually get passed,
right?
For example, right. It sort of looks at it's sort of the difference between, you know, the old line is that politics is the art of the possible,
right? Yes.
Whereas these rulings sort of rely on politics being the art of the hypothetical.
Correct. Yes. It is trivially easy for a judge on strict scrutiny review to take pot shots at the government's means, right? And again, we're talking the diametrical opposite of what happens on rationality review. Here's how means testing works on rationality review. The judge sits back in her chambers and says, well, the government says its legitimate interest is XYZ. And sure, that sounds legitimate to me. The government's law might be intended to accomplish this, or it might be intended to accomplish that. The judge will sit back and actively think of ways to make the law constitutional, to make the law rationally related to some legitimate government interest. Maybe the government was trying to accomplish this, or maybe the government was trying to accomplish that. Well, when the judge does that, it's going to be awfully tough for a challenger to defeat that law, isn't it? Precisely the opposite happens on strict scrutiny review. Does that make sense?
It's sort of the difference between, you know, an American judge and an East German judge in Olympic gymnastics.
There you go. There you go. Exactly right.
Back in the old days, you have to be older to understand.
Right.
There wasn't East German
That's right. When there was an iron curtain. Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. So let's get to, we don't have a lot of time. Let's get to the intermediate.
So I want to talk about intermediate scrutiny very briefly. As the name suggests, it's an intermediate level in between rationality review and strict scrutiny. It only applies to a handful of, a very small handful of things. Specifically, intermediate scrutiny is the formal level of review that applies to classifications based on gender and classifications based on illegitimacy, which is to say, were you born to your parents out of wedlock? Okay. On intermediate scrutiny review, the government bears the burden of proving, again, means test and ends test. The ends, the government must demonstrate that it has an important interest, not compelling, but an important interest that it is trying to achieve. And as far as the means test is concerned, the government must show that the law or classification substantially relates, not least restrictive means, but is substantially related to achieving some important governmental interest. So that's intermediate scrutiny. Those are the three basic levels of standards of review: rationality, intermediate scrutiny, and strict scrutiny. But before we
let me ask the obvious question.
Okay.
Why
the different levels of review?
Right. I mean, you just explained the difference. So a law that impacts on, say, racial discrimination.
Yes.
Has to meet a much higher standard.
Yes.
Than a law that impacts on gender discrimination.
Well, it's, as I said, when we see the government starting to draw distinctions, starting to dole out benefits or allocate burdens on the basis of things like race or national origin or gender, we say to ourselves, well, now, wait a minute. What is it about somebody's skin color that makes them more deserving of this burden or less deserving of this benefit? Or vice versa. And the answer is almost always going to be an infinitesimally small number of cases. Is there ever going to be a reason for the government to go there? So when the government does go there, we want to use a very demanding standard of review to make sure that the government's interest is really what it says it is, and that the way the government is going about achieving that interest is really what the government says it's doing. Does that make sense?
But the courts are essentially saying here that protecting women against discrimination is less important than protecting racial minorities against discrimination.
Yes, in a sense, that is true. And that has to do with the steps that a court goes through, the factors that a court looks to in determining whether or not a particular class merits heightened scrutiny. And that, in fact, brings me to this fourth standard of review, and it's something that I do want to talk about because it's an important development, and we're going to see more developments with relation to this fourth standard of review. We know we've got basic rational basis review, we've got intermediate scrutiny, and we've got strict scrutiny. There's a fourth standard that probably belongs somewhere between ordinary rational basis review and intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny. It's what is sometimes referred to as rational basis with bite. Rational basis with bite. We see this standard of review used in cases where the court concludes that the government's motivation for whatever it has done is simple, good old-fashioned animus. We don't like this group just because we don't like them. Here's where this originally appeared. It appeared in a 1971 case where Congress passed a law that restricted the ability of so-called hippies to qualify for food stamps. The Congress said, we're limiting the ability of people who are not related and who live together to qualify for food stamps. Hippies in the mid and late 1960s and early 1970s. The court invalidated that law, and it did so because it said this is nothing more than animus towards this group of people we call hippies. The government doesn't have any good reason not to like these people. It just decided it didn't like these people, and so it was going to penalize these people. So,
and the other series of cases, let's put this out there too, that probably are more familiar to our listeners.
Yes, exactly.
In which this came up were the series of gay rights cases.
That's exactly right.
Justice Kennedy, that, and it started with Romer versus Evans.
Yes, that's correct.
Which overturned a Colorado law that forbids local governments from passing any anti-discrimination protection
right.
based on sexual orientation and such.
Yes.
And in those cases, and in the three subsequent cases, Justice Kennedy never would go beyond rational basis with bite. He never
correct.
Would say, you know, there's historical discrimination against gay people that warrants suspect class, certification, that warrants extra protection right. and extra scrutiny, but still struck down those laws.
Correct.
Without actually upping the standard of review, which is a very unusual circumstance. I mean, they stick out because they are really exceptional.
That's correct. And one of the reasons why I'm glad you went there. That's where I was going to go. And one of the reasons I wanted to go there is this. Our good friend, Brendan Beery, and my colleague, is doing some really important and significant work with relation to this particular rational basis with bite standard of review. He's about to publish a law review article in a noteworthy law review. I'm afraid I can't say which one, but he's about to publish an article that is going to have some important things to say about this. And one of the things that he is going to say in this article is that this rational basis with bite standard that was used by Justice Kennedy to advance the rights of LGBT folks all across the country is about to get clipped by the new Supreme Court with the elevation of Justice Kavanaugh to the court. There are now going to be 5 votes who are not at all sympathetic to LGBT rights and LGBT interests. And so what that's going to mean in practical terms is that this animus-based standard that is grounded, by the way, in a finding of political unpopularity. That's the language that you find courts using when they justify something by relation to this animus standard. No longer will LGBT folks be characterized by the Supreme Court as a politically unpopular group that merits this elevated level of protection called rational basis with bite or rational basis with teeth. Brendan, our friend, calls it incursive rational basis review. What you need to know is that once a court finds that the government's motivation for a particular law is animus, that basically is the end of the story. At that point, the government has lost the case. And it's an interesting contrast with genuine rational basis review, where the government almost always wins. On incursive rational basis review, guess what? The government loses. And that's been a uniform thing every time this standard has been applied. So the significance of this is rational basis with teeth is going to be a thing that's going to last, but we're probably going to see it being applied to other groups, like in, for example, the Masterpiece Bake Shop case
that was
just handed down this past term. The court is going to focus its animus review on groups like the Christian majority, for example. And you might say to yourself, what does that have to do with being politically unpopular? And the answer is, your guess is as good as mine.
Well, the answer is that they think that that's the case, or at least they claim to. And it just suddenly occurred to me that while Justice Kennedy probably thought that he was threading a needle there that with this very narrow ruling on motivation and intent and not giving his conservative colleagues a weapon they can use to strike down his earlier gay rights rulings, he may have handed them exactly what they
wanted. Precisely the problem, Ed. That is precisely the problem. The rational basis with bite standard that Justice Kennedy clung to, rather than finding that LGBT people were a quasi-suspect class that deserves intermediate scrutiny, or a suspect class that demands strict scrutiny, he tried to, as you put it, thread this needle with what our friend Brendan Beery is calling incursive rational basis review. And what he probably has ended up doing is handing the court a sort of easy, tailor-made weapon to ratchet those protections back in the not too distant future, I'm sad to say.
Well, you can I could write the ruling.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I could write the majority
ruling.
That's
correct.
It's going to be, look, nowadays everybody loves gay people.
That's right.
Everybody's concerned about their rights,
right.
But nobody cares about Christians and their rights and the effect that it has on their families, which is none, of course.
And guess where you're going to find the precedent for this, Ed? You're going to find it in Justice Scalia's dissenting opinions in cases like Romer, right? And the other LGBT cases where...
And the Texas sodomy case in particular.
Correct. That's right. Lawrence case. And we talked about this in one of our special segments, I think it was a few weeks ago. Remember, we talked about how a justice will often drop a line or a paragraph or a section into a dissenting or concurring opinion and then just walk away, knowing that sooner or later the composition of the court is going to change and what he or she said there will eventually become the majority view. Well, guess what? If you want to know how the opinion's going to read, go back and take a look at Justice Scalia's opinions in the prior LGBT cases. That's how it's going to read.
There was an article just yesterday by Michelangelo Signoreal in the Huffington Post, in which he made the argument that forget about gay marriage, that the Christian right sees this as an opportunity to reinstate sodomy law.
Correct.
And certainly there's a big portion of them that does. Now, I don't know how easy that would be to pass now, these days. Certainly more difficult than it would have been 25 years
today, ago. Tomorrow, but, next week, not likely. But if you're willing to be a little bit patient and just sort of erode the right over a period of a few months or a few years, eventually you might get right back to that point. I saw a news article today. I can't remember where I saw it, but an elderly gay couple that's married and been together for 40 years were refused admission to a faith-based retirement community on the basis of the fact that it conflicted with their faith. I mean, discrimination in housing, discrimination in employment, these are things that are likely to become more and more prevalent.
And this clash between the right of religious people to discriminate and the right not to be discriminated against, we're going to spend the next 20 years fighting this out of the
court. No question.
This is where this is all going.
Yes.
You know, and you know, getting back to the original subject, and I want to wrap this up. The standard of review that the court decides to apply when those cases get up to them will almost entirely determine the outcome of those cases.
Correct.
And that's really, I think, the message of this supplemental podcast is that it's the first thing you should ask when you're reading a Supreme Court ruling. The first thing you should look for, what is the standard of review being applied?
That's right.
And you've given, I think, a great, if brief, explanation of these terms of art so that people can understand the difference between a legitimate interest, an important interest, and a compelling interest, and who the burden lies on. Those things matter enormously.
That is absolutely right. That's right.
And there are things that are rarely mentioned in popular media accounts, unless you're reading someone that really knows what they're talking about, like a Dahlia Lithwick.
Right. Well, as I say, this is part of the judicial toolkit. It's the nuts and bolts of how the judiciary goes about doing its job. It's not the sexy stuff, but it's the important stuff that you really need to know in order to understand why what happens.
And we should do, and I wanted to say, I want to wrap this up. We should do a future show on how this relates to the idea of common law.
Correct.
Because that essentially is what this is this sort of slow development of legal principle piled on top of legal principle. So that it, you start with the Constitution, but then you build up this body of law on top of
right.
that, which is essentially how the common law operates.
Right.
And that would make an interesting show, I think, for later on as well. So let's stop there. I hope this has been very informative for our guests, for our listeners. And I think it's a great place to start, because once you decided the standard of review, everything else just kind of flows from that.
Correct.
And so we hope that we've helped people understand when they read future Supreme Court rulings exactly where that's going. And we're going to continue this series a couple times a month of explaining these concepts. And I'm not sure what the second one will be, but we've got a couple more in mind to do for the next two. And we hope to have you back again to listen to those just for the supplemental podcast, or only for those listeners who support the show financially through our Patreon account. Nobody else will have access to them. So we hope you've enjoyed them. We thank you for supporting the show. And we will see you again next
Thanks,
time.
Everybody.
Singing born of this nation, of white bread foundation, we're taping our king beaten off his crown. My country, tears of the sweet land of our